Make sure it's working. It's not. This isn't working. So I don't know what took on my hand. Okay. Oh, right. Okay. Well, if this fouls up again, then we might consider that for now. Okay, let's go back on the record. We do have some problems with the technology, so if it comes up again, I'll let you know and we'll have to stop, but let's just proceed with what we have.
Did we lose some testimony?
We did not get some of the testimony recorded.
Can you give me a sense of where we need to repeat?
We would have to...
It stopped at 221.
221, which I don't...
A while ago.
Yeah, about 20 minutes. I don't see how we could repeat it, really.
Well, I just want to make sure we're not creating an appeal issue. I mean, there is case law to the effect that a missing recording is fatal. So I obviously don't want to repeat the testimony, but I think we have to.
We would have to at least repeat Ms. Hershey's testimony as to her background. So we have that. I don't know when that started. When did that start? So we could do the redirect. I got the answers to my questions, so that's a few minutes of that. Do you have your redirect questions for Mr. Bishop?
Well, I apologize. I just want to make sure we're not creating a mistake that's going to come back to haunt us if we don't.
Well, we have two options. We can either just forge ahead and not have that on the record, the recorded record, or we can repeat it. And the only way to fix that is to do it now.
Yeah.
So, and I honestly, it's not that much time, so it would be better to redo it now. And that would be my preference, unless someone objects to it.
We have no objection. I was just going to offer a suggestion, at least for a lot of Mr. Schneider's redirect was spent rereading pages that have already been transcribed. An option here would be just to simply enter those two pages of the deposition transcript, and that would eliminate at least the need to reread that again.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I appreciate the suggestion. That would be fine.
We'll provide those pages when we have a minute.
Would you, Mr. Schneider, would you look at your notes and make sure that that's going to cover all the questions asked on redirect?
I think the other topic we covered, Mr. Examiner, was the comparison of the city's warning zone and its environmental document with the incursion zone. So maybe we should briefly recall Mr. Bishop to go over that issue
mm-hmm.
again.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Hershey. If you can just step aside and we'll bring Mr. Bishop back. Mr. Bishop, you're still under oath, and we're going to do some redirect.
And if I may, maybe if I don't get an objection, I'll just try and be efficient here. For example, you followed up with some questions, and maybe I can just see if we all agree on the pages that Mr. Bishop identified. But, Mr. Bishop, I think I asked you before the recording stopped, or I guess after the recording stopped, to compare your incursion zone with the city's warning zone. Can you do that for us again, please?
Well, it might be best then to look at figure 1-8 in the EIS, which is the one that was identified showing the warning zone.
And I think you said that was on page 121 in the FEIS?
121, correct. And so the in this figure, there's different shades of gray and tan. There's a flag that identifies a driveway crossing warning zone on the upper side of the truck turning out, and you can see the green paths of the truck turning out. And the in this instance, actually, the green wheel of the right wheel of the truck turning out crosses the curb line in a shorter distance than the warning zone shown on this figure. So my incursion zone would be a few feet shorter in this instance. And I couldn't figure out what was defining the length of the warning zone. So in utilizing CAD, we like to use the technology, and it can identify, if you identify a point, you can pick distances and add them up really easily. So we picked the spot where the truck wheel or the swept path crosses the curb line. So in this case, it would be a little bit shorter than the warning zone shown there. Basically, it's the part of the trail that's adjacent to the buffer zone or parking area or whatever is there between the trail and the roadway that might have a truck going through the buffer.
So, Mr. Bishop, I think the examiner also asked you where in the EIS is the list of driveways that you compared or that you used in determining which driveways the EIS talked about.
Yes.
And you identified Table 5-2 in the Transportation Discipline Report on page 5-4 and described that as a list of the driveways for all of the alternatives. Is that accurate?
That's of the Transportation Discipline Report, not the parking one.
Okay. Again, page 5-4.
5-4, yeah. Yes. And there's a corresponding figure that shows physically these locations on a map. I should be able to find that. Back in the
Bishop, in the interest of time, let's just stop there. I think the table was what you testified about last time.
Yes.
And then if we can agree then that as part of the redirect, I had Mr. Bishop and I read from his deposition transcript beginning on page 17, line 4, through page 18, line 10.
And we would just offer the cover page and those two pages as something that
would should be not be adequate.
Mm-hmm. So I found it as figure 4-1.
Okay. And that
has got the
that'll be exhibit 2, the deposition. Okay.
And it will just take a little time to get that.
That's fine. I don't need it now. Okay. And I think that, Mr. Schneider, is that everything we had for redirect?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
So thank you again, Mr. Bishop. Ms. Hershey, we'll ask you to return. And just pretend that didn't happen. So please state your name and spell your last name for the record.
My name is Claudia S. Hershey, spelled H-I-R-S-C-H-E-Y.
And do you swear or affirm that the testimony you provide in today's hearing will be the truth?
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay. Ms. Hershey, you've been through this once, but because of the malfunction of the recording equipment, I want you to give us a succinct version of your background. How long have you been a transportation engineer?
Well, my undergraduate degree was a B.S. in mechanical engineering from the University of Washington in 1980. And then I received a Master of Science in civil engineering from the University of Wyoming in 1985, where all the coursework was in transportation engineering and traffic engineering.
And I believe you testified you've been the owner of Transportation Consulting Services for the last 6 years.
6 years.
Give us the overview of who you worked with before then, please.
I began my career with the Washington State Department of Transportation, was there for 3 years. Then CH2ML, now CH2M and Jacobs for 3 years. David Evans and Associates for 11 years, where I had significant project management experience. Heffron Transportation for 6 years, and then Transportation Consulting Services, my own firm, for 6 years.
And describe for us, please, how many NEPA, SEPA reviews involving transportation that you have been part of.
Well, I estimate I've worked on over 32 NEPA or SEPA transportation elements, where I've prepared the methodology, the analysis, and the documentation. 12 of those were major NEPA SEPA projects. 6 of those had major pedestrian, bicycle, and safety project elements, where pre-design occurred in coordination with that transportation analysis.
Mr. Examiner, I'm going to interpose an objection here. The witness appears to be reading from a statement, and witness testimony is supposed to be from recollection first, not from a written statement. To the extent that she needs notes to refresh her recollection, she's entitled to do that under ER 612, but that's only if she can't testify from recollection first.
Oh, okay.
And
you're
then entitled to review what she uses to refresh her recollection.
Well, again, we were trying to be efficient by going quickly, but if you want to review her notes, you're certainly welcome to, and it will slow things down a little bit, but that's fine.
Sustained.
Do you want to see her notes?
I would, yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
I have an extra copy.
And if you like, we'll enter it into the record. Okay, so, Ms. Hershey, looking to your notes only as necessary, can you pick up where you left off, please, and summarize for us the SEPA-NEPA projects that involve pedestrian or bicycle safety?
Well, I estimated that there were 6 of those projects, and I've developed a summary of 3 projects, for example.
Okay.
If you'd like.
And I think, again, but for the malfunction you were describing for us, a Kirkland project for Sound Transit. Can you give us, again, the succinct version of the work you did on that, please?
Okay. So for the Sound Transit Kirkland projects, where I was project manager of both the NEPA EA and the transportation team and transportation analysis, we began the project studying alternative locations for direct access through the Kirkland Corridor and I-405 using the Federal Transit Administration, or FTA's, alternatives analysis process. And we narrowed that to a preferred location, where we began developing alternatives that were evaluated for direct access. As I recall, included with the direct access on I-405, which is where the bus stops, leaves the HOV lanes and stops on an elevated platform at an arterial overcrossing. It included that element plus a transit center to the east and park and ride to the west with bicycle and pedestrian improvements to connect to those facilities. It involved a lot of discussions with the OT in order to develop a more pedestrian and friendly environment in the vicinity of an interchange than normal DOT standards at the time would have allowed for.
So I think in your testimony that didn't get recorded, you referred to a 30% design. So explain to us what the level of design means, perhaps using this project as an example for purpose of environmental review. Why was that project at a 30% level of design, and how do the did the designer and the environmental reviewer interact?
So the 30%, we worked towards 30% design on this project and many others in order to define the project footprint. So, for example, we're defining the lane widths, the shoulder widths, the number of turn lanes, the length of turn lanes. All that affects the footprint that's achieved. And it also, in transportation, obviously affects how the intersections will operate. If they're signalized intersections, it all affects how we phase the signal and the amount of green time we give to each phase. So, for example, say a turn lane needs to be, we think as traffic engineers, it should be 300 feet long, and say it intersects with a driveway that's fairly high volume and we think that's an undesirable condition, or it can even impact, say, a Class A wetland. We may want to shorten that turn lane. When we shorten the turn lane to avoid an impact, we're redesigning the entire intersection, maybe changing signal phasing, which changes the resulting level of service analysis. And we go through an iterative process with all the elements of the environment in review constantly, and our transportation design being constantly updated as we work through each of these analyses.
So what can you tell about the impacts of a project at 30% design that you can't tell at 10% design?
It depends on how the project team defines their 10% design, but I'll just give some more typical examples. For example, at 10%, you may know you can achieve 10 to 12-foot lanes, but at 30%, you might be able to define that we can achieve 10.5-foot lanes or 11-foot lanes. In that example, on a major truck street or a major transit street, the standard is 11-foot lanes, so you would know, you typically know by 30% design confidently what design standard you can achieve, and at 10%, you probably haven't quite achieved the level of confidence. You're still talking about ranges of design.
And you've reviewed the EIS in this case and the plans and the level of design they're at?
Yes.
And how would you characterize the level of design used in this EIS?
I would characterize it as 5 to 10%.
And how common is it for you in transportation projects in SEPA-NEPA review to achieve a 30% level of design?
Most of the projects that I have worked on achieve 30% design.
And can you give us a couple of other examples of SEPA-NEPA transportation projects that you worked on where 30% design was what was achieved during the environmental review?
Another project that I managed was the Sammamish Park and Ride Lot for Sound Transit. Again, we went through FTA's alternatives analysis project, evaluating alternative locations for the park and ride, narrowed that through screening and methodology to one location, and then began designing the project and preparing a NEPA EA and SEPA. With that project, we had an opportunity to provide using it a driveway for the park and ride. At the back of that, we had an opportunity to provide a connection to a neighborhood, providing key pedestrian bicycle access for a neighborhood, as well as by developing that local roadway at an adjacent intersection, we were able to eliminate a dangerous left turn lane. And there was some significant and interesting and natural environment issues that also got involved with a design iteration process. But we had a new signalized intersection, we had closing a left turn movement, and a new roadway involved with the park and ride.
And have you achieved a 30% level design in the environmental review for agencies other than Sound Transit?
I worked on washed up WSDOT projects doing similar work.
Okay. So have you been engaged to do the transportation element of EIS projects, transportation projects, where the work would you have done would be comparable to the work that was done in this case?
Yes.
Okay. So I'd like you to describe the process that you go through and compare it to what was done in this case. So what's the first step in doing the SEPA-NEPA review for a transportation project from the engineer's point of view?
From the engineer's point of view is to look at a couple of things. Number one is the scoping document so that we understand what are the issues of concern for all those participating in the scoping, which is typically some level of public involvement, all the agencies that would be involved with review of the NEPA-SEPA, and then decision makers, because ultimately we'll bring a recommendation to the decision makers. So when I look at all that, I develop study methodology for transportation to define the data collection and the analyses such that it will answer the questions that were raised during scoping and will answer the questions that we anticipate decision makers will have about the project and choosing the preferred alternative.
And can you tell from reviewing the EIS in this case whether what you described is what happened?
I would say no, and I could give a couple examples.
Please.
Well, one of the examples is that the both the Shale Show alternative, Shale Show South, Shale Show North, and then the preferred are all on Shale Show Avenue, which is a major truck street, major industrial street. And so obviously the industrial community is very concerned with the movement of their trucks and the safety of that truck movement and the interaction with bicycle and pedestrians. And then there needs to be a legitimate comparison of the conditions across each alternative to provide decision makers with information they need to compare alternatives.
So what information do you think, based on your experience, should have been collected here that wasn't about to allow that comparison of alternatives?
Based on my professional opinion as well as the research conducted, it's really all about the level of conflict between bicycles, pedestrians, vehicles, and trucks, with the level of conflict and potential risk and severity of a collision much, much greater for the trucks. So I was actually asked to, if I could come up with a methodology to evaluate safety. So it ultimately ended up very focused on the number of conflict points for a multi-use path and the type of traffic passing through each of the conflict points.
So at the request of the coalition, did you prepare a report?
Yes, I did.
Okay. And Mr. Examiner, the report is in Volume 2 behind tab A311-16. If we could all turn to that, please.
I have Volume 1 of 10.
Yeah, we're writing it.
I like my own notes better, but I like numbers better than talking to.
And can you give me that number again, Volume 2?
Yes, it's A311-16. Ms. Hershey, your report is a thick document. It consists of 19 pages of your text. Is that correct? And then the rest of it are exhibits and attachments?
Yes.
Okay. So explain for us in general terms, before we turn to the content of the report, what you did, what information you gathered that is not in the EIS to prepare this report.
Primarily, summary of the information I gathered was an inventory of each of the driveways along each of the alternative alignments, and in addition, identify, because we only had driveway volume data at select driveways and only along Shosho, so for each of the driveways on the Ballard alternative and Leary Way alternative, I made a in the field made a qualitative assessment as to the type, so whether or not it was residential, commercial, industrial, and I estimated in via my notes if it had a heavy industrial use or light industrial use, and notable along Leary Way was a number of driveways that were basically abandoned, no longer in use.
So is it fair to say then that you walked all of the alternatives and personally inventoried the driveways?
Yes.
So, Mr. Examiner, again, I can wait and offer the report after it's talked about, and we're going to be spending the next hour or two talking about it, or I can offer it now, however we want to proceed.
And I think our only, I guess this is going to be for the examiner's preference, our only objection is what are included as attachments. And there are a lot of studies and guidelines which, in our experience, the expert testifies to and provide the relevant information. The relevant evidence is the expert's understanding and communication of those to the examiner, not having a record filled with hundreds and hundreds of pages of studies that aren't specific to this project. That said, we saw what was in theirs. We have reports and studies listed in ours. We're prepared to go either way. But this is the first point at which, if those studies are entered, we're going to be similarly entering a lot of studies that we think are relevant. And I just want to leave that to the examiner to decide what the record should include.
I think the evidence rule for expert testimony, allows the foundation for the witness's testimony to be made part of the record. I think it would be best to have whatever documents that the experts relied upon made part of the record by both sides. Just offering documents that aren't, being used as the basis for an expert's opinion, I might take issue with that. But to the extent either side has an expert that is relying on studies or documents, I suggest they ought to be part of the record.
It's a broad invitation. without even knowing what you're talking about, it's very difficult for me to make a general ruling as to what type of attachments will be allowed in with a expert's exhibits. I agree with you, Mr. Schneider, that if it's supporting their testimony and something they relied on, that gives it much more probative value than it would otherwise. But we've all seen reports that have been relied on that we're wondering why we're all talking about it in a particular hearing. So I can't give a definitive ruling on any of that right now. One of the problems we have is our large exhibits coming in with lots of attachments instead of separating them out. So we can also separate out.
Well, then my practical suggestion would be I won't offer it at this time. We'll go through and talk about it, and then we can see if we have objections at the end.
That'll be fine. The only thing I need is some reference, so we can, if we can refer to it now as Appellant Exhibit 3, A3. Just for the record, that's when you offer it, it's not a problem.
So, Ms. Hershey, I want to use your report as the impetus for asking you questions. And obviously, you're not going to read your report to us. You're going to explain my questions. So, or explain your answer to my questions. So, I want to direct your attention to the second paragraph. Can you explain for us what issue you're identifying there with the EIS document that you reviewed?
I'm not sure what you're... What, in the second paragraph?
Yes, the second paragraph is introduction and background. For example, the second-to-last sentence talks about a general conclusion not being supported by analysis. Can you just give us... explain... what the issue with the EIS was that you're identifying in this paragraph?
So as I mentioned prior, the primary concern is the conflict and the level of severity of the conflict and the volume at conflict points. And the FEIS in the methodology, in the safety portion where they define methodology, I believe it's the first bullet, says that there will be an analysis of conflict points. And the next mention of safety in that analysis of conflict points is in the conclusion section for each alternative, providing qualitative statements about the conflict, but no. So then what's missing in between is there is no quantification or specific analysis of conflict.
And so maybe it would be helpful at this point to turn to attachment 2 of your exhibit, which is very close to the end. Do you have a copy? I'm sorry, the version I'm using doesn't have the specific page numbers, but we'll get those. It's these pages.
Conflict diagrams?
Yes. There are pages 210 and 211. So when you talk about conflicts, can you explain what you mean when it comes to this particular project and what we see on these two pages, 210 and 11, that are attachments to your report?
Okay, I'll just begin with page 210. And what I drew upon there was from Federal Highway Administration, FHWA's website, of a typical intersection and analysis of conflict points. Each intersection is very unique and it can get complex, so I just started with somebody else's example. There are three types of conflict points. There are crossing conflict points. So each conflict point is a potential interaction between vehicles, be it non-motorized or motorized vehicle. So the types are crossing. And there's a merging conflict point where two vehicles can basically merge into each other or sideswipe, and then a diverging conflict point. So what this sort of general intersection example is showing, originally it showed a one-lane bicycle, the conflict points for one direction of bicycle travel through the intersection, and then the red markup is the additional conflict points for the contraflow movement. It does not include the conflict points for all the turning movements a bicycle might make at that intersection. And the green dots are the conflict points that would occur for pedestrians. So if you could just envision a pedestrian going from left to right or west to east across that crosswalk, there will be right-turning vehicles and left-turning vehicles and through vehicles that all create a potential conflict point, which is a way of assessing risk for that pedestrian.
So on the left, there's a solid circle that says conflicts unique to bicycles, and then an open circle, conflicts in common with motor vehicles. Explain that distinction, please.
Where are you reading? Oh, on that. Okay. The solid dots are where two bicycle movements have their own potential conflict point. So you can see from what would be the west, a bicycle movement going north, and then a bicycle movement that would be in the lower right corner and going north would have a potential conflict point. And then the open circles are where the conflict points for the bicycles interact with vehicles.
So again, just so those of us who aren't traffic engineers can understand that, what is a conflict unique to bicycles? Does that mean there isn't a motor vehicle involved, or what?
Yes. Yeah.
And so this would be a what would the car
be? Well, no. It would be a bicycle or a vehicle. But it's because it's a conflict point for a bicycle going through the intersection.
Okay, well, we may come back to that. Let's turn, what's the next page then? It says representative driveway intersection conflict diagram.
Yes, so what this one is a typical driveway, which is very easy to translate this condition to all the driveways, whereas the intersection can be have all kinds of complexities. So what occurs here, the vehicles, the circles with vehicles in them are showing the vehicle conflict points, and the orange versus red stars are showing the conflict points of one of them's pedestrian movement and one of them's bicycle movement with a vehicle. So in a single direction bicycle flow across the driveway, you have four conflict points, two for pedestrians and two for bicycles, and then in the contra-flow direction, you have another four at a driveway.
So
in addition to the vehicle conflict points that occur with every driveway.
So how many additional conflict points does a two-way bicycle path introduce to a driveway intersection?
It introduces four in addition to the one-way.
And so would that be four additional conflict points at each driveway?
Yes.
So let's turn back to your report. At the top of page 2, the second paragraph, you refer to the clear risk factors of contraflow bicycle movements. What are you talking about there, please? I'm referring to the second line in the first big paragraph.
Okay, so the clear risk factors of contraflow bicycle movement documented in existing research. There's another number of documents I've summarized in the report that describe how the contraflow movement is creates a much more complex decision-making process for drivers leaving the driveway. So, for example, as a truck or a vehicle leaving a driveway along the shill show alignment, that vehicle must look to see that there are gaps between bicycle and pedestrian flow coming from two directions, as well as there's a gap to enter the roadway between vehicular volumes in two directions. So it's a two-step thinking process. Where do I have available gap to cross both the driveway and enter the traffic stream? So the level of complexity is quite a bit higher than for one direction of bicycle flow. For a vehicle, another example is for a vehicle making a turn from the roadway into the driveway when it's a left turn. So if you imagine on Shill Show where a vehicle is facing westbound, wants to do a left turn to the south, they're crossing oncoming traffic, and the pedestrians and bicycles in the contraflow direction, for them to look for them, they're turning their head more than 90 degrees to look back behind them in an unusual condition so that they can cross the oncoming traffic plus cross the two-way bicycle path when the coast is clear to make that movement. So a lot of the research discusses appropriate conditions for two-way bicycle trails as one where there are few driveways and minimal conflicts. And then additional research points to the accident rates with two-way bicycle facility versus single-direction bicycle facilities.
Okay, so let's go down the page then, page 2 of your report. You have a heading that says safety factors, findings from research.
Can you direct me a little more specifically? Part two. What page?
Page two still.
Oh, okay,
the
sure.
Heading. So can you summarize for us the findings from research that are set forth in this section of your report? And we may turn back to some of the attachments that you referred to.
Okay, so one of the primary reports I relied upon is the is from the National Cooperative Highway Research Program, acronym NCHRP, Report 500, entitled Guidance for Implementation of the AASHTO Strategic Highway Safety Plan, Volume 18, A Guide for Reducing Collisions Involving Bicycles, prepared in 2008. And in that, it cites a higher level of crossing path crashes. It cites the percent of bicycle motor vehicle crashes that were crossing versus parallel and other. It also provides, which is later in the report, guidance on when to appropriate conditions for considering a two-way bicycle path.
So according to that National Cooperative Highway Research Program Report 500, what percentage of crossing path crashes were involved bicycle motor vehicle crashes?
That was 57.5%.
And then what were the other percentages?
35.5% were parallel path crashes and 7% other.
So I think we can all visualize what a crossing path crash is. What's a parallel path crash?
That could be where both the bicycles going in one direction and a vehicle in the same direction, and say the vehicle, be it a passenger car, truck, is kind of errant, and so it kind of moves within the lane, and it may cross over into a bike lane, or if it's a shared condition, no bike lane, no buffered bike lane, there are crashes that occur when they bump into each other in parallel.
So the next document you referred to at the top of page 3 is called Why Can't We Be Friends? Summarize that document for us and what use you made of it in your report.
Well, the primary focus of the research was to look for availability of bicycle versus vehicle and truck accident data. In that report, I summarize what they summarize for three different sources of historical accident data.
And is that report prepared by the University of Washington?
Yes.
And again, what summarize for us what that report told you?
Okay, so they summarized a report of bicycle with motor vehicle crashes from 2002 to 2008 in Ohio, and found that the pickups, vans, minivans, and semi-trucks accounted for approximately 23% of the crashes, and the likelihood of a severe injury increased by 141% at intersections if the vehicle involved is a van, and at non-intersections, the severity was 100% if the vehicle involved a semi-truck. So basically saying the severity is much higher for larger vehicles.
And are larger vehicles, in fact, involved in a higher percentage of fatal crashes, according to this report?
Yes.
And what's the percentage for that? I'm now referring to your second bullet point.
Okay. This one was a bicycle safety study in New York City evaluating large vehicles, trucks, and buses. Trucks and buses were implicated in nearly a third of fatal crashes, while the vehicles were only 5 to 17% of the daily traffic. So you have a higher rate of fatal crashes resulting from the larger vehicles.
Okay. And what is the third bullet point tell us?
Well, was a New Jersey study result that identified that death or serious injury was almost twice as likely on a truck route than a non-truck route. And that would be, again, due to the volume of trucks.
And then you talk about a couple of more articles on that page that talk about the increased risk from two-way cycle paths. Is that correct?
Yes.
And summarize what those studies concluded.
Well, there was a study called The Risks of Cycling. A lot of people refer to it and discuss it where, oh, what did that one say? It basically, that report discussed the higher risks involved with the contraflow movement that occurs with a two-way cycle path,
and
that there was approximately twice the number of accidents on a two-way cycle track than single direction.
Then you refer to a report from the city of Boulder?
Yes, and that one was published in May 2016. And one thing I'll add is that there's kind of a paucity of information with regard to safety of bicycle facilities. The bicycling in the U.S. is growing really rapidly, and so we don't have sometimes we're lacking data. In addition, we don't have near the volume, so you can't have these big global pictures on data. However, I was very intrigued by the City of Boulder, Colorado report because it's recent, May 2016. They have a very high level of bicycle usage in that town and many bicycle paths. And in that report, they found that accidents in the where bicycles are traveling in the contraflow direction were three times that of bicycles traveling in a single direction. And so my point is with Boulder, it's based on quite a large volume of data compared to other sources we have.
And then what is your last bullet point on that page reflect?
Well, it reiterates the issue with bicycle motor crashes and two-way cycle paths being more dangerous.
Well, does Dr. Sainen from the Helsinki study have a conclusion about whether a two-way bicycle path is safer or more dangerous than having cyclists ride in the street?
His opinion at that time was the two-way bicycle path was more dangerous than even riding in the street in a single direction.
Mr. Schneider, let's take a break there for 10 minutes.
Okay.